From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Tom Calvinese is the coordinator of the Oregon Kelp Alliance, a fisheries scientist, and the field station manager for Oregon State University in Port Orford, Oregon. Thank you, Tom, for being here on the Oregon Grapevine. I appreciate your time and expertise, and I'm glad that you're here. We see kelp. I've seen kelp millions of times walking on the Oregon beaches, possibly ignore it, possibly play with it, possibly jump over it. What are the kinds of kelp that we find on the Oregon beaches, and what is their importance? Why does it matter?
Great question. And, you know, you do often, certain times of year, usually when the storms start to come through and those the big waves come and they basically rip that kelp off the bottom of the ocean where it's held down by holdfasts and ends up on the beach in these big mounds that we call wrack. And that's typically mostly comprised of bull kelp. And we call it bull kelp, or some people say bullwhip kelp, because if you stretch the whole thing out on the beach, you'll notice that it kind of looks like a big long whip. And at one end, it has a holdfast that it attaches to the substrate, to either rocks. Sometimes you'll even see the rocks or the shells that it's been attached to that have been ripped up with it, and they're still attached. And then that long piece is called the stipe, and at the top of that is a ball that's filled with gas, and that keeps the fronds that produce the energy for the plant, or the algae in this case, keeps it at the surface by just floating. So that bull kelp is what we call a foundation species, and the reason we call it that is because it is sort of the foundation of an entire ecosystem that emerges and surrounds that bull kelp. What it really does is it creates this three-dimensional structure in the ocean, and lots of things in the ocean like structure. The ocean is just sort of a big open area, a three-dimensional space, and fish and other organisms would like to associate with something, either the bottom in some cases, but with the kelp there, it creates this vertical structure. And so now sometimes you hear it referred to as a kelp forest. And the reason for that is that it you know, sort of echoes that sense of being in a forest where you've got these, you know, the kelp is sort of the trees of the forest. And then you've got things that live at the bottom of the, you know, on the ground in the forest, and some things that live up in the, you know, up in the trees. And so you see that structure in the kelp forest. And, you know, it really is a very biodiverse ecosystem that's composed of the kelp and all of the sort of organisms that are associated with it, from plankton to invertebrates and fish and marine mammals and even big whales. So it really is super important in those areas where we have rocky habitat, which we have a lot of here in the southern coast, and that kelp really produces that kelp forest habitat. And without it, it's just not the same. You might think about it in terms of the difference between a forest and an area that's like been clear cut, let's say. So you've got this really rich sort of ecosystem in the forest, but if the trees are gone, it's really not like, it's not the same thing. So it's sort of like that when you look at the kelp, you know, it's really providing a whole ecosystem habitat and actually food for a lot of organisms. Some of those kelp fronds will break off and sink to the bottom and produce food for all kinds of critters that live on the bottom, including things like abalone and sea urchins and crabs and other things. And that kelp, even after it washes up on the beach, provides food for that whole beach ecosystem. I'm sure many of you have probably walked past the big pile of kelp on the beach, and it's just popping with life. It's got all kinds of little sort of bug-like critters bouncing around on it, and might find little crabs in there. So everybody's feasting on all that, all those nutrients. And kelp can also sequester carbon. It absorbs a lot of carbon out of the ocean as it grows. It grows very fast. It can grow like a foot a day. And if the kelp that doesn't wash up on the beach or get absorbed or eaten by other critters can float off way offshore and then ultimately sink down into the deep ocean and actually sequester some of that carbon. And we're learning now that that's a pretty important function that it provides to the ocean sort of ecosystem.
What is the state of Oregon's kelp?
Well, we are honestly sort of trying to figure that out right now. What we are seeing is that, we can look south to our neighbor in Northern California, where they have seen pretty massive losses of kelp forests for multiple reasons. And because here in Southern Oregon, we share a lot of attributes with that ecosystem, we are noticing some similar issues in certain places. So I think it's really important to understand that the ocean is not homogeneous. In other words, it's not the same everywhere. So what you find when you go and look at what's going on in the ocean is it looks one way in one place and it looks different in another place. So what we are finding is that in certain places, we've seen the loss of kelp forests. And in other places, they're doing okay. But increasingly, we're becoming more and more concerned about how many places where we're seeing this kelp go away and wanting to take a closer look and get to the bottom of this, figure out what is actually going on and what, if anything, we can do about it. One of the things that we're doing is we are doing some survey work. We have not surveyed kelp forests in Oregon in about 10 years. And during those 10 years, a lot of things have happened. A lot of changes have occurred in the ocean related to temperature, related to different species either disappearing or having been disappeared a long time ago, and increases in the populations of other organisms. So some things seem to be sort of out of balance in a lot of places. And so we need to get a better handle on what exactly is going on. But we can tell that in certain places, we are certainly seeing places where there once was a pretty healthy kelp forest, and now there's not. And so that's really drawing the concern of a lot of folks, in particular of divers, because divers, you know, we spend time underwater. And so we spend time looking around and paying attention to what it looks like down there. And when you get used to seeing a certain kind of a seascape when you're underwater and it has changed pretty drastically, you know, that can be cause for alarm. And so a good number of divers up and down the coast have taken notice of that and have called attention to the need to really see what we can do to understand what's going on and then take action to see if we can address those issues.
Let's move to some of the creatures that hang out down there, urchins, for instance, or sea stars or other animals that are there. What seems to be the status of that? And I'm assuming that they're symbiotic. How does that work?
Yeah, so how it works is, like many places in the world, you know, we're talking about an ecosystem. So kelp forest ecosystem has all of these players that you just mentioned, from the kelp to the urchins, the sea stars, abalone, fish, whales, plankton. And at one time, there were sea otters that lived in that system. So sort of what's happening with these different kind of characters in that system? Well, first of all, it was probably about 100 years ago that we hunted otters to local extinction, I'll call it. So we don't have sea otters in the system in Oregon anymore. And that matters now, because now we're looking at a system that's sort of disrupted and out of balance in some places. And the otters had a role in that system to help keep it in balance. And so with them missing, that makes it harder for the system to stay in balance. And then you mentioned sea stars, and the listeners may have heard about something called sea star wasting syndrome. And that occurred several years ago. And we're not quite sure exactly what went on there, but we know that a lot of sea stars up and down the coast, up and down the West Coast, died off. And you may have noticed more recently, a lot of them have come back. the ones that we're familiar with seeing in the intertidal here along the coast, the pisaster. Sometimes you see them, they're like dark purple, or they might be kind of an orange color. And they have seemed like they've kind of bounced back and they're doing pretty well. But there's another one called the sunflower sea star that you may have seen. It's sort of like a big disc, and that one has many, many arms. It's not like a typical five-armed sea star. That's why we call it a sunflower sea star. And unfortunately, that one, which we call Pycnopodia, has not recovered. And the problem with that for this story is that they actually are predators. So they eat sea urchins. And one of the issues we have right now is we have too many sea urchins in some places. And so now we have another predator that's taken out of the system. In fact, they were listed as a threatened species recently. There are folks that are working on that right now, working on possibly raising them in captivity. Maybe at some point we might actually try to release some back into the system to help bring balance back into it. We're not quite there yet, but there are people working on that. So those sea stars are our key player. The abalone are sort of a featured character in this ecosystem. And unfortunately, they have not done very well lately because they compete with urchins for food. And when there are too many urchins around, abalone really just can't get enough to eat. And so they are kind of, some of them are sort of starving, or at least malnourished. So we're really concerned about that, particularly since they were fished pretty heavily in the past. So they've actually been put into a no-take sort of status by ODFW. So you can't take abalone, and that's with the intention of giving them a chance to for their populations to recover. But then here they are in competition with these, you know, massive numbers of sea urchins that leave them with really not much to eat. So we're really concerned about that too. And then, of course, the urchins, the purple urchins in particular, we've seen a very large increase in their populations, partly due to the loss of predators, but also just because they happen to have a couple of really good years for their recruitment. And so all those factors together and all of that behind, you may have heard of what was referred to as the warm blob several years ago, this just big mass of warm water that was sitting offshore, and it was intruding warm water toward the shore. And warm water isn't really good for kelp. Kelp likes cold water. It's much more nutrient-rich. So we have this kind of perfect storm of characteristics of the ecosystem, from the warm water to the loss of predators to a big increase in these herbivores, the urchins, these grazers. And as a result, you end up with what was once a healthy, biodiverse ecosystem of kelp forest, that in some places now is what we call an urchin barren. And barren's the right word because the urchins have eaten everything. And now what you're left with is just an area that's just got a bunch of urchins in it and not much else.
Is there behavior that listeners, we can do to help?
Well, one thing that we're doing, I think you mentioned at the introduction, I'm coordinating a group called the Oregon Kelp Alliance. So this is a group, pretty sort of a multi-perspective group, diverse group of folks from kelp forest scientists to ODFW shellfish biologists and managers to divers and eco-tour operators, even chefs and members of Indian tribes and lots of different people that are really interested in the health of our kelp forests. And so we are coming together on the regular basis and really working on multiple levels to address this issue, from doing more surveys. We're partnering with a group called Reef Check. They've just established an Oregon arm of Reef Check and hired a local coordinator. So they're helping with the survey work. We have other scientists doing surveys, Dr. Aaron Galloway and Dr. Lee Torres, working on the kelp to whales project that's looking at the linkage between the kelp forest and the whales that depend on the food that aggregates around the kelp. We're working on some additional funding through Sea Grant to continue a project we're doing right now, which is an experimental kelp restoration project at five sites along the Oregon coast where we're doing these surveys to determine the sort of status of the kelp forest. And in areas where it has sort of converted to an urchin barren, we're actually doing some active restoration work where we're removing urchins in an attempt to create the conditions where the kelp can recover. So we are involving volunteer divers in that project. So if you are a diver who's been trained, who has the skills to sort of work underwater, then we have begun to sort of execute this kelp restoration project here at Nellie's Cove in Port Orford, and we'll soon be doing similar activities in some of the other sites. And they stretch from Brookings in the south all the way up to Cape Lookout on the north coast. That's an experimental project. So we are doing a classic sort of experimental design, looking before and after, and applying this technique in a treatment area and in comparing it to an area where we're not doing that, so we can see the effect of doing this kind of urchin culling to promote kelp restoration. And we're hoping to also go out and seed that area once we clear the urchins out so that we can promote the return of the kelp forest. And then in the long, sort of the long view is to establish essentially a kelp forest stewardship program. Once we're able to, if we are able to restore areas where there is now, where we can get a healthy kelp forest back, then work to maintain that. The ocean is changing in a lot of ways, and so we really can't predict the future. How is this all going to end up? But what we think is a good idea is to at least establish some of these sort of oases where we have healthy kelp in the system producing spores, which is how the kelp reproduces. And we want to make sure we don't lose all of it so that in these oases, we can have kelp that still produces spores that can sort of, if you will, kind of reseed surrounding areas under better conditions. So those are some of the ways people can help. We've been working with a group called Wild Human to produce, they're helping us out with like digital communications. So if you go to OregonKelp.com, there are some places on that in that story where you can find out more. You can sign up to help with the project. And I think probably the most important thing for everyone to do is to really understand that there's a lot going on under the surface. And when you look out at the ocean, you may not notice necessarily that these things are happening or these changes are occurring. So if you're listening to this, you're already doing something by just paying attention and learning more about what's going on with our kelp forests in Oregon.
You have stayed away from any conversation about climate change and the ocean. Is that on purpose?
No, not at all. There's so much to talk about in terms of this issue. You know, the kelp forest is so complex. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier about how kelp can sequester carbon, these changes that are happening in the ocean are definitely, in many of them, are definitely related to global climate change. Increased temperature in the ocean. You probably have also heard about something called ocean acidification, and that's the result of an increased amount of carbon being dissolved in the ocean and producing a more acidic ocean. So these factors, you may have heard recently about areas where we're seeing a loss of dissolved oxygen. So things in the ocean, just like us, everything needs oxygen to live, or most things do. So not having oxygen dissolved in the water is a big problem and can actually lead to places where there's actually dead zones. So these big global problems are part of the picture. I mentioned earlier about the sort of warm blob that caused this warm water that was not favorable for kelp. We don't know if there's a direct relationship between global climate change and sea star wasting, but that's a possibility. Warm water tends to not be so good for animals that rely on cold water. So, you know, we're really in the learning process right now about the ultimate effects of these kinds of big changes like temperature acidification, loss of oxygen. But most organisms in the ocean are, you know, they're pretty adaptable, but within a range. And I think what we're experiencing now is that that range of fluctuation of conditions that is a natural part of the ocean and the rest of the environment, that we're exceeding it in some places. And, you know, that's causing or at least contributing to some of these imbalances that we're seeing. So to relate it more directly to the whole kelp question, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's one of the fastest growing organisms on the planet. We tend to call it a plant. Technically, it's an algae. But in any case, that kelp is extracting a lot of carbon from the ocean as it grows. And it, as I mentioned, it grows very fast. Could grow for, you know, could grow a foot in a day. And so that's pulling a lot of carbon out of the ocean. And that's a, you know, that's really important as we are pumping more into the atmosphere and more of that is getting dissolved in the ocean. We need those kelp forests to help absorb that and return it to the system, or, as I said before, kind of sink to the bottom and actually sequester that carbon. So these kelp forests are really important regulators of the carbon balance in the ocean, or the carbon budget, sometimes we say. So they really matter in that way. And the other thing that's really important about them is that they actually provide some protection to the shoreline. So as we're looking at increased sort of, we're looking at sea level rise in some places, those kelp forests actually help to protect the beaches and the shoreline from erosion. That wave energy that comes rolling in toward the shore, if there's a healthy kelp forest there, it can help absorb some of that energy, and by doing so, it can minimize the sort of erosive effects of the ocean. So there's all kinds of ways that it, you know, it really provides, you know, it helps to promote a healthy ocean, healthy planet, healthy shoreline. And I think the other thing that I think is super important for folks to understand is how important kelp forests are to a lot of our commercial fisheries. So I'm a fisheries scientist. This part really interests me because I've spent a lot of time studying, for example, a lot of the rockfish species that are really valuable to our commercial fisheries, and also things like lingcod and cabazon and other fishes, even salmon, particularly when they're just baby fish. They really depend on that kelp forest for shelter, for food. You'll find them up in the kelp, what we call the canopy, those fronds that sort of sit at the top of the ocean, you know, at the surface of the ocean. That's great habitat for all those little baby fish to hang out once they sort of stop floating around like little plankton, and they start to kind of figure out where they're going to live as adults. They end up sort of in that kelp canopy, like I said, sort of being protected, and they're finding food there. And that's super important for them at that stage in their life. And then as they get older, many of them are sort of associated with that kelp forest because of the structure, because of food availability, protection from predators, etc. And so, you know, at multiple points in their lifetime, these fish that we depend on for food, for our commercial fisheries, our local economies, they are depending on that kelp forest too. So it's really important to us in that way as well. So, you know, there's just so many ways that it's a really important component of the ocean ecosystem.
You can age a tree by counting its rings. Can you age a big piece of bull kelp?
Well, the bull kelp is sort of an annual, you could say, and not strictly, because sometimes some of them will survive through the winter. And if you spend any time in the ocean or you go kayaking or something, you might encounter one that's, you know, a bull kelp or a patch of it, or even one bull kelp that looks like it's kind of been around the block, a little bit ragged, and has other seaweeds growing on it. And that's just because it managed to survive through the winter. But most of that kelp actually just sprouts from one of its life stages. It actually goes through two stages of its life. In the first stage, it's kind of microscopic. It's what's called a gametophyte that grows out of the spore. And then The second stage is what's called the sporophyte, which is the big kelp that we end up seeing. And that sprouts as a little tiny sporophyte kind of in the spring. And then by the summertime, it has reached the surface. And then as you go into the fall and the winter, as the storm energy starts to increase, and you start seeing these big waves come and just hit the shore, a lot of that kelp gets ripped up and deposited on the beach. That's why you see those big lines of kelp rack on the beach after winter storms. And then it starts all over again in the spring. So as far as aging it goes, most of it, has a one-year life cycle with a few exceptions.
Interesting. If you could wave a magic wand, are there maybe two things you would want changed about either how we're dealing with all of it or what would be changed in the future magically to make it work?
Well, the first thing would be that we have to do a better job of actually examining the problem. And by that, I mean, we need to survey our kelp forests in Oregon. We haven't done a comprehensive survey of kelp forests in Oregon in 10 years. And so that's one of the things the Oregon Kelp Alliance is working on right now with, amongst all of our partners. We're all kind of figuring out in different ways. We're launching different surveys and in particular areas for different purposes. But we are hoping that we can launch a program where we can actually involve folks who might be either divers or kayakers, or maybe you're a drone pilot. And we're going to try to do a sort of a community science initiative where we can engage folks in this process of monitoring our kelp forests and surveying them and really getting a better handle on what is going on and where we have problems. And then I guess the other thing I would say is that the kelp forest restoration work that we're doing is also going to be really important. If we have areas where we're seeing a loss of kelp forest, to make sure that we take action to not completely lose it and to do restoration work. I think what I'm really talking about here is shifting our thinking about conservation in certain areas, and I think this is one of them, from, a passive kind of conservation where we talk about protecting things, and I'm all for that. We create marine protected areas I live near one right now at Redfish Rocks. And so we decide, we'll refrain from extracting things from this place, and that will help contribute to the health of that ecosystem. But I think now we're looking at different phenomena like this one, where maybe it's time for us to sort of take a more active approach to conservation. And in saying that, what I'm talking about is restoration work. So we may be looking at a situation where we have to become active stewards of our kelp forest and engage in a more, just a more active approach to conservation that involves restoration work. And then, of course, if I can add a third thing, I think we really need to take seriously the effects of introducing so much atmospheric carbon into the system. And it's really having an effect on our oceans, and we've got to take that seriously and really start thinking about ways to mitigate it for the long run. So for now, I think we have to take action and be active stewards of these very valuable ecosystems. And in the long run, we have to think about ways that we can turn things around in terms of ocean chemistry and the effects of temperature and changes in ocean chemistry on these ecosystems. And that's going to be a long game. That's going to take a lot of work and a lot of planning, and it's going to be a big job for a lot of people for a long time. And I think that's another sort of, maybe it's a positive sort of component of this, is that it is a lot of work, and it means that we are going to have to invest in these kinds of restorative mariculture projects, and that's work for a lot of people.
Thank
That's
you.
Probably more than the two things you asked for, but you asked me to, imagine what could be. So there you have it.
Perfect. I asked you and you responded, and I thank you greatly. And I appreciate your time. I learned a lot, and I look forward to talking again down the road.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you so much for this opportunity, and thanks, everyone, for listening. And, you know, go check out your nearby shoreline and think about what's going on under the water there.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh, pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.